Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the FBI balance its twin missions of fighting crime and gathering domestic intelligence, and how often in its 103 years in operation has the agency bent or bypassed the laws restricting its surveillance activities? Much of the story of the Federal Bureau of Investigation is intertwined with that of J. Edgar Hoover, the deeply driven and often controversial figure whose tenure as director lasted from 1924 until 1972. And whether they trusted or disapproved of him, the presidents under whom Hoover served were each in some way influenced by his ideas about how the agency should operate and the role the FBI could play in American law enforcement and national security. Here to talk about all this is Tim Weiner, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI. Tim, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
So the FBI has its very public mission of fighting crime. Intelligence gathering is also a major priority. What made you want to focus on that side of operations for this history?
Well, Chris, in fact, intelligence operations are the majority of what the FBI does, and the number one mission since 9/11, and indeed for much of the past century. The crime fighting, stop the bank robbery, find the stolen car part of the FBI is a tiny visible tip of an enormous iceberg. And the FBI is really the closest thing we've ever had to a secret police in this country. They are the guys who have to find spies, saboteurs, people who want to overthrow the government. And this has been going on since World War I.
It seems that for as long as the FBI has conducted surveillance, it has conducted illegal surveillance from time to time. First of all, tell us a little bit about what the agency was like before J. Edgar Hoover took over.
Well, it was a small, weak force that had been created by President Teddy Roosevelt back in 1908. And one of its main missions was to crush anarchists. An anarchist had murdered President McKinley in 1901. That's how Teddy Roosevelt became president. And they had murdered kings and queens and dukes and princes across Europe for decades before. This really became a threat when the United States entered World War I. At that exact time, J. Edgar Hoover joined the Justice Department. What the FBI did during and after World War I was to identify and conduct mass arrests of people who were ideologically opposed to the United States, thought crimes, really. Bolsheviks, communists, anarchists, pacifists, people who opposed the United States entry into World War I. And in a series of nationwide dragnets, swept up somewhere close to 10,000 people and threw them in jail.
And the vast majority of those people turned out not to be guilty of anything.
Correct. They didn't find any spies. They found people who could be deported because they were Russians and believed in the Russian Revolution. That belief was illegal under the law in 1917, and Hoover led this. He led the biggest counterterrorism operation in the history of the United States when he was 25 years old. And before he turned 30, he got control of the FBI.
So that was in 1924.
Correct.
And what's interesting here, Tim, is that Hoover is often portrayed as this shadowy, almost omnipotent figure. But in fact, he understood better than anybody else that his power could wax and wane and worked pretty aggressively throughout his career to get what he wanted, not only by these brute threats, but by flattery and by gossip.
He was a genius of a kind, strange kind of a genius. He was not a monster. He was a Machiavelli. He was someone who understood power at the presidential level, and because he served presidents from Woodrow Wilson to Richard Nixon, an unbelievable span of six decades, he knew how to get presidents' attention, and presidents knew that the FBI was the way to spy on their enemies, foreign and domestic. Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 called Hoover in to the White House. They were one-on-one. And FDR said to Hoover, listen, I want you to develop a very clear picture of the communist and the fascist threat to this country. Now, war clouds were rising in Europe. Stalin was running the Soviet Union. Hitler was running Germany. There was going to be a war. And Hoover went to work, wiretapping, bugging, breaking and entering, stealing people's documents, even though the Supreme Court outlawed wiretapping a few years later, he kept right on doing it because the president told him to do it.
And in fact, the president told him to do it and allowed him to do it without the, let's say, distraction of any kind of congressional oversight.
Any oversight at all. When the Supreme Court outlawed wiretapping, President Roosevelt called Hoover back in and said, in so many words, in writing, to hell with the Supreme Court. I'm ordering you to keep right on wiretapping and bugging and breaking and entering in the name of the national security of the United States. World War II was on in Europe by then. Pearl Harbor had not happened yet. But Hoover took this mandate, and he kept it. And he kept it without any questioning well into the 1960s.
So it never bothered him as court decisions would come down over those decades of time that would say, this is not allowed, that's not allowed. I guess the takeaway for J. Edgar Hoover was, keep doing it, just don't get caught next time.
In the realm of espionage, wiretapping, bugging, national security, J. Edgar Hoover was the law. And this is a very dangerous thing in a democracy. The Constitution commands us to strike a balance between national security and civil liberties. But every president at war, and most of them since FDR either have been at war or think they are at war, hot war, cold war, war on terror, every president at war is willing to kick the Constitution into the gutter. And Hoover was the man, the method, the power to gain secret intelligence on the enemies of this country.
It's fascinating that Harry Truman never fell for it. That Truman...
Well, they hated one another.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, poor Harry Truman. My God, Franklin Roosevelt dies in April 1945. The war is still on in Europe. The war is still on in Japan. And Hoover doesn't know anything. He doesn't know about the bomb. He doesn't know about the powers of the presidency. And he believes that the FBI is, in his words, quote, an American Gestapo. He does not want to use these powers, and he does not want to get into the war on communism at all. Well, J. Edgar Hoover does, because he feels throughout Truman's presidency that Soviet espionage is burrowing into the United States, into the Pentagon, into the CIA, into the State Department, and even into the FBI. And he was right. People think Hoover was paranoid, but even paranoids have enemies. And he did.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be an interesting thing for you as you're going through this history and trying to understand his motivations, because you do have to, you have to acknowledge the fact that there were things to be legitimately afraid of, even at the time that Hoover was overstepping his boundaries.
You bet there were. I mean, the Soviets had stolen the secret, not just of the atomic bomb, but of the hydrogen bomb, which is infinitely more powerful. The Soviets had penetrated the State Department and the CIA, and Hoover felt that he was the man who could defend America from these threats, including the threat, which he envisioned as early as 1947, of a kamikaze attack by airplanes on American cities, of dirty bombs. He saw this, he envisioned these threats almost 55 years ago.
So Truman, who cannot stand Hoover and is concerned about...
And the feeling is mutual.
Yes. he essentially creates what will be the bane of J. Edgar Hoover's existence, the CIA.
Correct. Now, he didn't want the FBI overseas. During World War II, they were all over the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. He wanted them pulled back to the borders. And he creates the CIA... because we are a superpower now. There's nobody left. The British Empire has fallen. Russia is in ruins. Japan is in ruins. Europe is you know, in smoking rubble. And we're it. We have to defend Western civilization. In order to do that, you need intelligence. You need to know what your enemies are up to. So he creates a CIA, and Hoover didn't like that one bit because he wanted to run that show, didn't he? And he had been proposing that he run the worldwide intelligence for the United States for years. This rivalry, Hoover's hatred of the CIA, and the CIA's distrust of Hoover, goes on and on and on for decades, long after his death, and the friction between them is one of the central reasons for the successes of the 9/11 attacks.
Was it a mistake, do you think, Tim, for President Truman to have not only created the CIA, but to have said, and by the way, no one who's been associated with the FBI will be allowed to be employed by this new agency I've created?
Well, that was Hoover's edict. Mm-hmm. Hoover said, nobody who has ever worked for me will go to work for the CIA over my dead body. No, it was not a mistake, and here's why. At this point, after World War II, we were the only superpower on Earth, and we were going to be projecting our power all over the globe in the name of democracy, freedom, and anti-communism. In order to do that, you have to have an intelligence service, a worldwide intelligence service, because when intelligence succeeds, it can prevent war. And when intelligence fails, people die. Did he like the idea of having to do this? He didn't. Felt he didn't have a choice at that point. It was like whether to drop the bomb on Japan. He felt that was not a choice at all. He had to do it. And so the haberdasher from Missouri becomes the most powerful man on Earth. It is a mantle that he did not wear comfortably. And in his unease, the mantle slipped. And Hoover became enormously powerful. He was more powerful than Truman in many ways in his impact on America. He is the man who invented American anti-communism.
So he spent vast resources trying to root out communism in this country, but he ultimately did not want to help out Joe McCarthy.
He did it first. His people, his agents on Capitol Hill, slipped McCarthy a good deal of information. And when McCarthy's hand was steadied by Hoover's secret intelligence, he sometimes hit his targets, and they were accurate targets. But there came a point, we have to remember that Senator McCarthy was an alcoholic, a liar, and a pathological man. There came a point where he began to attack the army, and at this point, J. Edgar Hoover and the new president, President Eisenhower, decided that McCarthy was doing more damage to American anti-communism than he was doing to communists, and they cut him off. Without Hoover's hand to steady him, he began to misfire, and he finally began to attack the army, and at that point he was crushed, and he drank himself to death 3 years later. He temporarily wrested the role of leadership of American anti-communism from Hoover, but not for long.
Why do you think Hoover was so dedicated to finding communism and eliminating communism, which may very well have been a threat, but didn't really bother with the KKK, which was a proven threat to a very large segment of the U.S. population?
Well, that is a two-part question. Hoover went after the KKK hammer and tongue in 1964 when President Lyndon B. Johnson ordered him to do it. Let us remember that the Klan was the most violent and murderous terrorist organization in 20th century America. The Klan killed thousands of people, blew up churches, murdered kids, shot people in the back, and, just as dangerous, controlled through fear and force the state police, the local police, the sheriffs, throughout the Deep South. And Lyndon Johnson wanted to pass the Civil Rights Act, didn't he? Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be elected, and he wanted to be elected with a clean sweep in the South, and he wanted blacks to be able to vote. So in the long, hot summer of 64, he orders Hoover to destroy the Klan. And within months, the FBI broke the Klan like a dry twig.
Let me jump in here. We're going to take a quick break. We can get the rest of that response in a moment from my guest, Tim Weiner. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI. If you've got a question, you can call now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tim Weiner. His new book is called Enemies, A History of the FBI. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Tim, before the break, you were telling us that finally in 1964, under the orders of President Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover did in fact turn significant FBI resources toward breaking the Ku Klux Klan.
There's a marvelous tape which you can hear on the internet at the LBJ Library at University of Texas in Austin. Mm-hmm. And the two men are talking. President Johnson taped the call. And President Johnson says to Hoover, "Edgar, I want you to gather the same intelligence on the Klan that you gather on the communists." And Hoover says, "Yes, sir." And he used the same techniques that he used on American communists: wiretapping, bugging, breaking and entering, sabotage, poison pen letters. And the FBI destroyed the Klan completely. And it was a remarkable achievement. Now, of course, at the same time, at the exact same time, Hoover is also trying to destroy Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
He believes the problem in the South is not the segregationists, but as he put it, the integrationists. And he is bugging and wiretapping Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to a fare-thee-well and trying to destroy and defame King. These two seemingly opposite missions are happening at the same time. And it's an extraordinary glimpse into how the power of the president gets used by the FBI to try and shape the American body politic.
What sort of indication did Hoover give to MLK that he had information about him that could be embarrassing?
There were two kinds of information that Hoover used to try and destroy Martin Luther King. The first was that King's closest associates, and in particular his white counselor, speechwriter, ghostwriter, advisor, a man named Stanley Levison, had been a member of the communist underground, not the party, but the communist espionage underground in this country in the 1950s. And Hoover suspected he still was, and that he was using King as a cat's paw for Moscow. Hoover told that to President Kennedy and to President Kennedy's brother, the Attorney General, Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby signed the order authorizing the FBI to bug and wiretap King. And that order stayed in force for years. With these bugs and wiretaps, Hoover picks up evidence that Dr. King was enjoying the company of women who were not his wife. And he circulates these tapes all over Washington, just as Dr. King is about to accept the Nobel Peace Prize in an attempt to defame and destroy him. It's an extraordinary and painful chapter in American history. And the use of the FBI in this regard, with the full knowledge of presidents, is a very, very ugly and unpleasant tale.
Hoover was not above spying on presidents themselves.
Well, he had a tape of John Kennedy in the same kind of compromising position. The reason being that the FBI was trailing a suspected Nazi spy, a beautiful Norwegian woman named Inga Arvad, as she left Washington in 1942 and went down to a Navy base in Virginia and had a very pleasant afternoon in a hotel with a young Navy lieutenant named John F. Kennedy. That's 1942. Now, Hoover's great friend was Ambassador Joe Kennedy's, the future president's father. And he let the ambassador know, and the ambassador let his son know that Hoover had this information. Is that blackmail? Not really. Could it feel like blackmail? Yes, it did.
How did Hoover decide who he wanted a special investigation of or a file on?
Ultimately, it's the president's decision. If the president wants to investigate, let's say, a broad category of American fascists or communists, as President Franklin D. Roosevelt did, or the leaders of the Civil War and anti-war movement and civil rights movement, as Presidents Johnson and Nixon did, the FBI does that. In our day and age, those priorities are set by the president and by the FBI director, Robert Mueller. We heard at the top of the hour about cyber attacks and the threat of cyber warfare. This is the number one thing that keeps the FBI director awake at night these days. So the choice of enemies is really up to the president, although consistently they have been people who want to blow up buildings and blow up the foundations of American democracy.
Tell us a little bit about the relationship between J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Nixon, because it changed a lot over the years.
It did. I mean, Hoover, when Nixon first gets to Washington as a congressman in 1947, Hoover spots real talent and says, that young man's going to be a good man for us. And he was. And the two men, two of the more complicated men in the history of America, these were men who really didn't have friends at all. They never loved anyone. They were not close to other people. But they knew and trusted one another, and more importantly, used one another in spectacularly brilliant ways to advance their own careers and enhance their own power. They did have a falling out. Late in Hoover's life, Nixon wants Hoover and the FBI to bug and wiretap not just the members of the violent anti-war left, but their friends and families without warrants. And this Hoover will not do, because if they get caught doing that, not the targets of an investigation, but their friends and families who have committed no crimes, if he gets caught doing that, the FBI will be wounded, and everything he has worked all his life to build will be tarnished. He won't do it. Nixon is furious, and what he does is set up his own little bucket shop, the Plumbers, ex-CIA and ex-FBI agents, to do that dirty work. And 6 weeks after Hoover dies, they get caught breaking into the Watergate Hotel, don't they?
And Hoover's successor was, in fact, at least somewhat inclined to do the president's bidding.
Well, in fact, on this very issue, the illegal bugging, wiretapping, and breaking and entering into the apartments and homes of the friends and families of the Weather Underground, the violent underground left, gets Hoover's successor, L. Patrick Gray, indicted by a federal grand jury because they went ahead and did it on Nixon's orders. And the number two and three men in the FBI, Mark Felt, better known today as Deep Throat,
sure,
and Ed Miller, are also indicted. And those two men, Felt and Miller, are convicted of multiple felonies in a federal court for doing the very things that Nixon had ordered them to do. They are pardoned by President Reagan during his first weeks in office.
So clearly this was a turning point, the death of Hoover and Watergate and everything, for the FBI. But it took a while to sort of shake off the culture that had been created over nearly half a century.
I would say it has taken 40 years. Hoover died 40 years ago, next month. We still live in his shadow. He is the man who created the modern surveillance state. Every time you walk down a street in New York City and a camera looks over your shoulder, every time you pass through an airport and your biometric data are collected, that is the system that Hoover created. He began it with the fingerprint file, and it has now expanded to our daily lives. We live in the national security state he created, and we live with his legacy every day. I would say that in the last 3 years, under the present director, Robert Mueller, who, God help him, took office on September 4, 2001. In the last 3 years, with Mueller, the FBI has been trying to get that balance right, this struggle between national security and civil liberties, between our desire to be both safe and free, as the Constitution commands us. I think they're trying to get it right now, and I think that they are in great part succeeding, and I think that that is remarkable.
And you have a really interesting story of Mueller, in fact, standing up to President George W. Bush.
He did, in the White House. The time is March 2004. The president has been running for 2.5 years an extremely secret and extremely powerful electronic eavesdropping campaign created after 9/11. And Mueller and his counterparts at the Justice Department, the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, have determined that this program is in some aspects illegal. It is overbroad. It is spying on Americans. It doesn't matter if you're you're opening their email or opening their mail, or if you're tapping their cell phones or putting a copper wire and an alligator clip on their home phones. It's the same thing. You need a warrant from a judge to do that. And if you don't have it, you are violating the law and the Constitution, and not even the president can do that. FBI Director Mueller confronts George Bush alone, one-on-one in the White House in March 2004, and says, we know what happened because we have Mueller's contemporaneous notes and Bush's memoir, and they match. The director of the FBI says to the President of the United States, Mr. President, either you scale this electronic eavesdropping program back or I will resign. And my letter of resignation is in my pocket right now. And I'm taking the Attorney General and his deputy with me. Now, what would have happened if Bush had said no? He would have resigned. And the next question is, why are you resigning, FBI director? And he says, I can't tell you. It's too secret. Well, the government would have fallen, Chris. Bush would have been impeached for violating the Constitution if that had been known in that way in that time. And the president knows this. He writes in his memoirs that visions of the Saturday Night Massacre danced in his head, the famous confrontation between Nixon and the Justice Department, when attorneys general resigned, two of them. And he backs down. Now that is power.
The other reality is that once a sort of government power has been established, it rarely goes away even after a time of threat to the country.
You are quite right. The trick of this, and it is a rather crucial trick because on it hinges our rights as free people in a free republic, is to strike the balance, or to try to strike the balance between security and liberty. The FBI has to wake up every day and get this right. And in the last 3 years, under Director Mueller, and I must say, under a president who knows constitutional law and respects it, unlike his predecessor, they are really trying to get it right. And after 103 years, the last 3 years, have been a rather remarkable stretch for the FBI. Do they overstep? Of course they do. They're human beings. This is intelligence is a human endeavor, and it is prone to human error. But they admit it when they get caught, and they keep trying to get it right. And in a democratic society, to have a secret intelligence organization with this kind of power, they have to get it right.
Tim, what sort of progress has been made in knocking down the silos that exist between the FBI, the NSA, and the CIA? And should those silos exist in some form moving forward?
Well, they are walls that create a maze or a labyrinth, if you will. Everyone knew, without the 9/11 Commission telling them, everyone in the FBI and the CIA and the other intelligence agencies knew that one of the reasons the 9/11 attacks succeeded was that the FBI and the CIA weren't talking to each other and not sharing information. And they have gotten better at this, but things really couldn't have been worse than the way they were on 10 September 2011. They have gotten better, and they are trying as hard as they humanly can to cooperate, because they know if we get hit again, civil liberties in this country will be over. And Mueller has said time and time again, FBI Director Mueller, listen, when I retire, I am not going to be the man around whose neck they hang a medal and say, congratulations, you won the war on terror, but you lost our civil liberties.
What was the motivation for not sharing information in the first place?
Professional jealousy, institutional hatred, bureaucratic mule-headedness, the usual. It's just human nature.
To what extent were lower-ranking people within the FBI aware that the things they were asked to do before the sort of reform of the agency were in fact illegal?
They felt that they were soldiers in an army and that the army was fighting genuine threats to the United States, communism, terrorism, and they did what they were told to do. And they felt that Hoover and ultimately the president from whom power flows to the FBI could do anything as long as it was secret. If it was secret, it was legal. And if the president ordered it, it was not illegal. That is a Nixonian philosophy that prevailed well after Hoover was dead and Nixon had fallen from power.
What did it take for the FBI to open in substantial ways to qualified women?
Took 100 years of struggle.
Yeah.
You know, the Hoover FBI mm-hmm. was 99.94% white, 100% male, really not until the 80s and 90s and the turn of the century did women get any kind of status or power in the FBI. They have it now, but that's a long struggle. It took two generations.
Would you say that's an improvement to the agency overall and not simply to the careers of individual women who want to be FBI agents?
Yeah, I mean, this is not because you want to have a diversity poster in the corridor. This is because you are trying to run an intelligence service here, and you are trying to understand the minds of your enemies, and the skill sets you have to bring to this include language, computer power, experience abroad. It doesn't require a Y chromosome to have those skills.
Tim Weiner is my guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI. If you'd like to join us, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tim Weiner. He's the author of the new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Mr. Weiner, does your book deal with the FBI's role in the so-called war on drugs? Back in the 1980s, I applied to the FBI. In conjunction with that, I spoke with an agent or two and other friends in federal government who knew something about the FBI. And they, at that time, the FBI, its reputation was that it did not want to be involved in the war on drugs. One big reason was the corruptive influence that getting involved.
That's exactly right.
So I was wondering if you had any more insight into that.
That's exactly right. The war on drugs is outside the ambit of this book, largely because the FBI didn't want a part of it. That's why, in large part, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, rose up. There are a lot of fields that Hoover didn't want to get into. Dope was one of them. Political corruption was another, and the mafia was a third. Why? Because he felt his agents might be corrupted, bribed, and that would be a disgrace that would bring down the FBI, bring down its reputation. He went kicking and screaming into mob cases, largely because he had a rival who was deeply interested in those cases, and that was the Attorney General of the United States, Bobby Kennedy. Those two men hated each other so deeply with a burning passion that their war actually changed the scope of American power and American history.
It is interesting that Hoover was not interested in organized crime, because didn't he really make a name for himself working in organized crime cases when he was with the Justice Department?
Those were disorganized crimes. Those were gangsters.
Uh-huh.
Those were bank robbers and John Dillinger. And yeah, it was wonderful publicity for the FBI. And to this day, I mean, the only thing people seem to know about J. Edgar Hoover is that he shot gangsters and that he wore a dress. And neither of those things is true.
Talk about that. You know, it's sort of a distraction in any conversation
sure
you have about Hoover, but you tried to see whether you could get to the bottom of these rumors.
Yeah, I'll tell you when the rumors that Hoover was gay started. They started in 1937, at the precise time that he started going after gays in the government. Hoover destroyed the lives of countless thousands of people from 1937 until he died 45 years later on suspicions of homosexuality. Why? Because, A, he thought it was a security risk as well as a sin against God, and B, he conflated homosexuality and communism.
I have to tell you that I read that in the book. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I'll tell you why. Some of the key communists from the underground that began cooperating with the FBI were, in fact, secret homosexuals. And some of the British spies who were working for Moscow in the 40s were, in fact, secret homosexuals, sometimes not so secret. And Hoover saw these men working in secret undergrounds, meeting in secret, talking in encoded languages, and he thought that they were two sides of the same coin. And that simply increased his desire to rid the government of homosexuals. We're still talking in this day and age about gays in the military, aren't we? He was talking about gays in the government. He destroyed a goodly number of them. The second he starts doing that, the rumor starts that he's gay.
Well,
he is a little queer, isn't he? He lives with his mother. He's 42 years old. This is in 1937. But there is absolutely no evidence that J. Edgar Hoover ever loved another human being in any way, shape, or form, including the physical act of love.
I suppose what's so interesting about the question of his homosexuality, or discovering and really ruining people finding out that they were gay and conflating these things with communism and terrorism, is that there were closeted homosexuals in every aspect of American life. They just, you know, he wasn't investigating all the bakers and furniture store owners and whatever. He wasn't investigating those people, so he wouldn't have discovered this aspect of their lives.
If you were in the government and you required a security clearance, as so many countless millions of people did, you had to steer clear of a homosexual life. If the FBI found out that you were homosexual, you were a security risk, and you were regarded as if you were an alcoholic or a felon, and your career in government was over. We will never know precisely how many people's lives were destroyed, but it is certainly many, many thousands. The FBI's files, when they were finally destroyed on homosexuals in government, ran to 300,000 pages.
Speaking of files, talk a little bit about the four cases of documents that came into your possession that allowed you to write this book.
Right after I finished my history of the CIA Legacy of Ashes, I got a call from a lawyer saying, "Hey, Tim, I've just won a 27-year-old Freedom of Information Act suit for Hoover's intelligence files. The guy who filed the case back in 1981, he doesn't want them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He's moved on in life. Would you like them?"
And
I said, yes, I would. And at the heart of this are thousands of pages of files, reports that went directly to Hoover with a blank half page at the end. And on these, he would write his orders of the day in blue fountain pen ink. And it's extraordinary, thousands of these orders coming down from Hoover from 1945 down to his death, written orders telling his intelligence officers what to do about the threats of the day, the month, the year. And reading these is like looking over his shoulder and listening to him think out loud, and it gave me a much deeper portrait of him as a human being instead of this cartoon caricature that we know.
What kind of personnel manager was he, Tim? I mean, how did he treat the people who worked with him?
He ruled by fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not a hair out of place, not a scuffed shoe, not a coffee stain on your crisp white shirt. He was a very effective ruler.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tony in Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Chris. You're a treasure, local and regional, if not national. Tim, I had a question for you. We locally, we had an organization called CISBES. I guess it was Community in El Salvador. I have more of a technical question than anything. I understand that I think it was the FBI that continually broke into their offices. I read some ridiculous number. They've been broken into 70, 150 times. It was just how do they subcontract that kind of work, or how?
No, here's what happened. Here's what happened, and it's a really famous case, and it should be, okay? In the early Reagan years, there was an organization called the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. As you remember, the Reagan administration was fighting on several fronts, supporting anti-communist guerrillas in Central America. CISBES was a left-wing organization that supported the Democratic left and, in fact, the guerrillas in El Salvador. The FBI got an informant on CISBES that persuaded them that this was a really dangerous terrorist organization, right? And so they investigated CISBES for years, and as if it were a terrorist organization, when in fact it was just a bunch of, you know, lefties who were opposed to the Reagan administration. And the chief informant in this case, who was a liar and a fraud, the FBI's chief informer was the son of the former chief of the National Police of El Salvador. So what is happening is that the right-wing military and security forces in El Salvador are feeding a load of hogwash to the FBI through this guy and destroying a perfectly legitimate political organization in this country opposed to American foreign policy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we go up to Wichita Falls to say hello to Beth. Hi, Beth.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Just a quick question. If you, if your guest saw the portrayal of J. Edgar Hoover in the movie that I think Clint Eastwood directed, and, yeah, I never thought I would go to a movie like that, but I thought it was I thought they were both robbed of any kind of a Oscar nomination. But my general question is, if you saw the movie and if you thought any of that was accurate, and I was curious about who his secretary was and if she went and destroyed the files that it looked like they portrayed that was depicted in the movie.
His lifelong secretary who served him all throughout his career was named Helen Gandy, and she started trying to destroy the files after his death, but she only got from A to C before she was stopped. And as for the movie, look, I'm not a movie critic. It's a Hollywood movie, not a documentary. But I think the idea that approximate cause of the Cold War was J. Edgar Hoover's repressed sexuality is kind of nonsense. I'll leave it at that.
It's got to be hard to enjoy the movie version of anything when you have spent years of your life studying the real story.
Reality is so much stranger and richer than fiction.
How aware do you think the FBI is today of the need for positive public relations?
Intensely aware, and they always have been. The FBI's PR office is pound for pound the most skilled in Washington, the Pentagon included. They fight tooth and nail for the public image of the FBI, and they do a terrific job doing that. And, you know, there are retired FBI agents who serve well. You've got one right there in Dallas, Buck Revell, who has really saved the FBI from a great deal of trouble by his conscientiousness in office during the 1980s.
We have time for one more phone call, and that is Vince in Dallas. Hi, Vince.
Hi. How y'all doing this evening?
Very well, thanks.
I was just wanting to ask your guest, you know, why did they come out with the RICO law and conspiracy laws if there wasn't a whole lot of the war on drugs with the FBI?
Right. You know, those were laws passed by Congress to use racketeering statutes against public corruption. For example, When I was a Cub reporter, they took down the entire command structure of the Philadelphia Police Department on a racketeering indictment. Racketeering is just another way of saying criminal conspiracy. And they use it in all forms of federal law enforcement investigations.
How does training work today within the FBI? Are people sort of tracked from the beginning of their training and to either collect intelligence or to work in the crime-fighting cases?
Well, it takes a special breed of cat to do this kind of intelligence work.
Sure.
And there's one common denominator throughout the years, and that is the Marines. If you were a good Marine commander, you're going to be a good FBI officer and a good leader. Mueller himself, Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI, is an ex-Marine, wounded in Vietnam. And it's not by accident the Marine headquarters and the FBI Training Academy are across the street from each other in Quantico, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, command authority in the Marines is if you send your men up the hill, you go up the hill with them. And that's the kind of guy Mueller is. People really don't know who he is, Bob Mueller, the head of the FBI. But I predict that he will go down when he retires, and his term has been extended for 12 years instead of 10. He's now served longer than anyone since Hoover in that job. That when he retires in 18 months, he will go down as the greatest leader the FBI ever had, J. Edgar Hoover included.
Hmm. Can we trust the FBI today?
You better. because if they get this wrong, this balance between security and liberty, it will have fatal consequences, and I'm that is no metaphor. No free republic in the history of civilization has ever lasted longer than 300 years. We're now in our 24th decade. At the heart of this is the rule of law. We have to live under the rule of law. We have to have national security and civil liberties. We have to have them together. The FBI wakes up every day trying to strike this delicate balance. And if it fails, we lose.
So are we doing a good job at balancing the need for transparency with the need, in many cases, for secret surveillance and secret information gathering?
No, because you cannot have a transparent secret operation.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. Some things can be secret. Some things need to be out there.
You and I both know that it is very hard to keep a big secret in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Look at President Bush's secret electronic surveillance program, probably the biggest secret in the American government. That lasted 2.5 years. No, I don't think we are, because the press is weaker than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Newspapers, television, investigative journalism is not as strong a force in our society. The government becomes more and more powerful in its powers to wiretap, survey, listen in. And look, we don't have to love Big Brother, but he is part of the family, and we have to learn to live with him.
Tim Weiner has been my guest this hour. His new book is called Enemies, A History of the FBI. Tim, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.